As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to what I hope is a very special episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. Jack Bennion from The Race here, your host. There's no J.R. Hildebrand today. We've got far too many people on the podcast to get through. One of which is Tony DiZino, who joins me. Tony, how are you doing?
I'm good, Jack, and thank you so much for the invitation. It's funny, J.R. I've known for well over a decade, so hopefully if I can match his pace and insight, I'll be doing all right.
Well, if you like what you hear from Tony, you can definitely check him out on Twitter. I think I recently referred to him as the IndyCar Twitter goat. I think that's the phrase that I used to describe you recently.
What was particularly funny about that is Marcus Ericsson started following me like 10 minutes after that tweet went out. So continuing the theme of the Race IndyCar podcast and Marcus ratings and what have you. So
our good friend. So the reason Tony's here today is we're going to interview all of the Road to Indy champions from this season. So this is hopefully to introduce those guys to you if you're an IndyCar follower and not necessarily able to keep up with the many, many junior series that there are on the ladder and the races that take place across the course of the season. We're going to give you a little refresher of what's happened this year. We're going to interview all of the star drivers from those championships. And Tony and I are going to shoot the breeze a little bit on each of them and try and bring some color to what has been their seasons. So, Tony, I want to start with Linus Lundqvist, obviously the championship closest to IndyCar, Indy Lights. 5 wins this season. His worst finish was 6th, which was also the race that he clinched the championship, ironically. And someone who has kind of been in the news a lot recently because he's got a super license through winning British F3 in 2018, the Formula Regional Championship in 2020, and now obviously the Indy Lights Championship as well. So he's been quite well, you'll hear him in the interview shortly, but I know outside of this podcast he's spoken about being willing to swap Colton for his IndyCar ride and Colton can have his super license, but I don't think the FIA will go for that, Tony, do you?
I doubt it, and frankly we wouldn't want to lose the guy that's Indy Lights champ to anyway, when he's very much due for his promotion based on how good he already was as a freshman and how much even better he was as a sophomore this season, where I think he entered the year for sure as a championship favorite, but quite how he delivered I think was even better and cleaner than even anyone anticipated, because it honestly wasn't much of a fight for most of the season.
Yeah, I mean, last year was pretty good. I mean, he was obviously at a massive disadvantage coming in as a rookie against Kyle Kirkwood and David Malukas, who, you know, we've already seen from Kyle over the course of his junior single-seater career, arguably one of the best we've probably ever seen. And David Malukas has obviously gone on to show in IndyCar what he's capable of and you know, why he was so much of a contender last year. So, and Linus wasn't actually that far away from him. And I think if he hadn't have had that tyre blowout at Gateway last year, I think he would have been much closer to that championship point, maybe not quite close enough to really challenge those guys at the end of the season. But I think it would have flattered him a little bit more, I think, you know, based on that. So yeah, we, like you say, championship favorite coming in. And yeah, I guess, is there anything specific that's impressed you, Tony? I think the one thing that I've liked about him this season is he seems to have learned what many young drivers have to learn the hard way a lot of the time, and that's to not try and win every race and kind of take the points that are available to you and try and find that consistency that balances you out and wins you a championship, because these guys are they're obviously so desperate to impress and show people what they're capable of doing, and winning races is obviously a big part of that. But also, if you want to win a championship, sometimes you just have to take the fourth positions, the third positions in Indy Lights. So I guess that's the one thing that's impressed me, you know, compared to last year. What stood out to you?
There were two or three moments pretty early in the season. The first was Barber, where it was one of the tricky Indy Lights was a really unusual schedule this year. It felt like there were two or three races that got interrupted by weather or by track conditions, or there was a fence repair at Road America. And so there was a gaps. The first race at Barber, Linus managed to, you know, hang on. It's a damp track. You're on slick tires, and how you kind of hang on in those conditions, you know, whether it's either slicks on a wet track or wets on a dry track, how you hang on to your car in those conditions is really interesting. It's a good sense of car control. Linus had a really good defense against his teammate Benjamin Peterson in that race. And, you know, coming off a third place at St. Petersburg, which was, you know, a bit of a lucky third place because a couple guys from Andretti went out in front of him and he only just got on the podium. That was his win. And then the same story at Indy Race 2, he got the win there. Similar, it got rained out. We had the Colton dominance in the rain, and, you know, fitting we would tie Colton and Linus together given the whole super license day. They went on the same day at the same racetrack. And, you know, the people that stuck around to see Linus win that second portion of the race, I mean, that positioned him in a really good spot. But once he got to Detroit and had just the dominant, utterly just destroyed the field weekend, pole, fastest lap, lead every lap, win both races. I mean, I remember writing going into that weekend, he had a 34-point lead, and I think he came out the other side with 84 points as everyone else either made a mistake or just fell back or didn't maximize their opportunities. And all of a sudden, boom, you know, the championship was his as long as he kept it smart the rest of the way.
Yeah, it very much felt like a year where, not to take anything away from Linus and what he was able to achieve, but there's a lot of like raw potential in the five or six drivers behind Linus who at various stages of the season just had a bit of bad luck, or, you know, were just not quite able to deliver some of that consistency we were talking about a little bit earlier on. And, you know, especially, you know, you mentioned Benjamin Pedersen, Hunter McRae, Matthew Brabham there as well, Stingray Robb, Christian Rasmussen, all guys capable of winning races, as we saw, and, you know, we're challenging at the front regularly, but just weren't able to do that on a more consistent basis. So I guess it's kind of a weird season in that sense, Tony, that we've got so many good drivers, but, you know, Linus was just the one who was able just to string everything together. And I guess maybe that points to, you know, an exciting next season as well with a lot of those guys coming back.
For sure. And it actually ended with six different winners in the last six races, if you can believe it, which I didn't even realize until after the fact, because guys did finally break through. But, you know, where Linus also was smart too, is he realized when things weren't going correct to not fight it too much. I mean, the battle he had at Iowa with Matty Brabs was crazy towards the end when they made the contact. They're coming off at turn two, and, you know, just, we didn't know who won, and then it literally changed, you know, right as Hunter McElroy was getting interviewed. He's like, yeah, I think I'm third, and yeah, no, actually you won mid, so everything went. But then anyway, when it got to Gateway, and it was a similar type situation, Linus didn't need to fight as closely as he probably would have if it was a tighter championship position, and taking that second place there was a super smart result, kept him in championship position, and, you know, Matty Brabs guys win there. So yeah, I think you're right, depending on how many guys come back, and particularly with some of the guys that are going to come up, as we'll see through, you know, the two other primary series within the Road to Indy Ladder, I think the Lights Championship should be probably a little more closely contested next year.
We should talk about that ladder, Tony, because one of the slight issues that we have with this podcast is that we did our interview with Linus Lundqvist before the news that the Indy Lights prize structure is changing slightly. So in the past, it's been $1.2 million or the value of, and three IndyCar races, including the Indy 500. Part of that was a sort of $500,000 kind of guaranteed prize that will remain, but the rest of that money is being now kind of directed through the teams as like a race by race funding situation. So a little bit unusual, because I don't think the teams and drivers in Indy Lights this year have had total clarity over this change. And I think a lot of the drivers are expecting the prize to remain the same that it was, or even become bigger for this season. And in actual fact, it's worked out for for Linus that he's getting a considerably, you know, less amount of money than he did before. How do you see this kind of impacting the structure? Because we've got to a kind of unusual situation now where Linus is taking, you know, roughly the same as the Indy Pro 2000 champion, Louis Foster, who's going into Indy Lights next year. So it's a bit of an unusual situation, isn't it?
It is, Jack, and it's a bit tricky because you essentially have two different owners or leaders or sanctioning body types between the Penske Entertainment run Indy Lights and the Anderson Promotions remainder of the Road to Indy ladder scale. So that's kind of, it's been kind of percolating, I feel like, in the background all year, how there's kind of the divergence between the two, but this is kind of the first physical manifestation of what a difference in dollar amount looks like. And it's peculiar too, because I know we're sitting here, you know, mid to late September, and most of the seats are available, or sorry, that they're not available. They're already filled. And if you're Linus and you now have a smaller budget available to bring, and if there's not an engine lease available, dependent on whether the fourth Chip Ganassi car runs full time, whether that doesn't, whether that then affects the coin potential third car, if that happens, which I know you've chronicled a bit, and the whole whether he's going to be in the second car, if that's not a full season deal, it's so many variables. And it's just unfortunate because if you're working towards the impression that you're on a scholarship, I'm going IndyCar regardless, and now you don't know if that guarantee is there. It's something that hasn't happened in more than a decade almost. I mean, I think, you know, we're going back 2011-12 time frame, and, you know, even guys like Newgarden and, you know, Vodier, Karam, Chavez, that kind of era, it wasn't necessarily guaranteed that they would step up. They had to still kind of either get hired or find enough backing on their own. It was really only when Spencer Pigot and the whole Mazda program came into fray that it was really good for guys to get the promotion. So yeah, it's definitely weird, and it's unfortunate that the timing of this is kind of broken so late in the season when you're not really able to think that far ahead for the future year.
Yeah, we had Linus on the stage at the Indy Lights kind of ceremony, or part of the Indy Lights ceremony where he'd won the championship, asking what the scholarship was going to be and what the situation was. So a really unusual situation, especially if you've got Benjamin Pedersen, who's managed to establish himself at AJ Foyt with a seat for next season as well. So we'll kind of wait with bated breath now with Linus. I don't think his chances of going to IndyCar are totally off the table because of this change, even though, as we'll go on to discuss in the interview, his kind of lack of personal backing and the difficulty that he faces funding his racing each year, there's still some options on the table for him, but it's definitely made things a little bit more difficult with this sort of prize revelation. So that being in mind, the interview you're about to hear doesn't feature any questions about that because the news emerged after we'd done the interview. We definitely promise in future The Race IndyCar podcast episodes to update you on Linus's progress and what's going to happen with him there. His biggest chance at the minute is, as Tony rightfully pointed out, the potential for a third Dale Coyne car if Ganassi don't run a full-time fourth car, which is kind of a situation born out of Jimmy Johnson deciding to go part-time for next season, or no time if he makes that decision. But we're kind of expecting him to do some ovals next year in the Indy 500 at least. So we'll keep an eye on that. Hunkos is another seat that's been kind of thrown out there into the ether, but I think this news is so fresh that Linus is now kind of feeling out the paddock and seeing what the situation is. So without further ado, let's go and hear a bit more about Linus Lundqvist's season in Indy Lights. So hello, Linus Lundqvist. Congratulations on your Indy Lights Championship. What have you been up to in the days passing since?
Yeah, hello, mate. Thank you. I don't know. I've been just trying to put this smile off my face, but it can't seem to go away. but it's been a good couple of days. Very fortunate to have my family here out for the race. So celebrated together with them. And right now I'm in LA, actually. We had a couple of days here before I'm heading back to Indianapolis.
Awesome. I guess tell us a little bit about your mental approach going into that last race, because I guess the championship was all but kind of wrapped up and you kind of knew it was, but I guess at the same time, you don't really want to go into a weekend with that attitude, do you? So I guess tell us a little bit about how you kind of approached that weekend.
Yeah, it was a little bit tricky because I think I've clinched championships before the last race, but this one was so, because obviously we had the chance of doing it at Portland, we didn't, and then going into this one, I knew that I had to start the race, and then it was over. So I actually thought that I worked through all the emotions and like winning it and knowing it for a little while. But yeah, that didn't really matter. As soon as I crossed the line, Jesus Christ, you know, the, like I was in tears as soon as I saw the checkered flag all the way into the podium, I think. So, so yeah, it was an emotional one, especially like you jump out of the car, you see your family and see the team that put so much effort and what it means to them as well. It's so, yeah. I thought I had it under control and sort of went through the process, but obviously I didn't. But I think it just shows as well how much it means, not only to me, but to the whole family and to the team as well.
Yeah, I guess talk a little bit about that, because obviously, I guess it's an old story in motorsport, I guess, that there's drivers out there who don't always get the sponsorship they should, or the backing that they should, or their families maybe aren't as, you know, well off as some other families out there. And I guess, yeah, does this championship mean a bit more just because, I guess for a start, you're kind of giving something back to those, you know, that small group of people who have helped you, but also at the same time, it's like a validation that you were capable of doing this all along when you had the right support and the right people around you.
Yeah, totally. And it's so much more than just the championship and this year. You know, it's all the moments that led up to this point and that we even started off in go-karts was a miracle, and to make it this far, the odds weren't in our favor. So just super, super happy and super proud of the journey that we've done. And like you said, you know, there's been so many people that's, you know, put their thoughts with me and hope that I could do well and supported my dream. So it was nice to kind of repay all of them and say that, hey, we did this together.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was very emotional.
Sure. I guess obviously the kind of single seater ladder, I guess you would call it, is kind of in the news a lot at the moment. And I think a few people have quite funnily pointed out that you've got enough points for a super license now. Whereas obviously there's people out there who don't, like Colton Herta, who are desperately trying to get one for their futures. But I guess just in a more general sense, maybe talk about, obviously you've grown up in the European ladder will be most familiar to you. So you've seen kind of how that works. But obviously now you've got a lot of experience of how this American ladder works as well. And I guess a key part of that for someone like you is that the scholarship system is, you know, it kind of keeps you alive in terms of, you know, keeping your career going, doesn't it?
100%. And without the scholarship system, I wouldn't be here today. You know, that was one of the key reasons to why I moved here to the US to sort of pursue this American dream. And obviously it was a dream come true from year one when we won the FR championship. And without that scholarship, I wouldn't have made it to lights. And about the season that we've had last year, I wouldn't have been here today. So obviously it's good to see that the system works. And now I just hope that what we did now in Indy Lights is enough to move up to the big cars. But it's funny you mentioned that I've got now enough super license points to actually, you know, qualify for F1, which is ironic that someone like Colton Herta doesn't. Actually is saying something about that at the press conference, because they asked me about it. And I said, well, maybe we can switch. I'll give him my super license points and I'll get his drive in IndyCar.
I'm sure that would be a fun swap for yeah, both of you guys. I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about the lights car and kind of try and bring the lights car to life for maybe some of the listeners at home. You obviously haven't got to drive one or maybe don't know necessarily about the style and stuff. And I know you've really enjoyed this kind of transition into, you know, learning how to drive the Indy Lights car and just how kind of sideways it is. And obviously that makes it great to watch if you're not a driver and someone on the outside who gets to watch. You know, it's great to see you guys with like the onboards and stuff, seeing how, you know, kind of sideways and stuff the car gets. But talk us a little bit about through the process you've gone through in terms of learning how to kind of extract the pace from that, because it's such a, I guess it's kind of like the opposite of how you imagine like a European style single seater championship would be, like keeping everything straight and, you know, looking after the tires in a really particular way and things like that. Indy Lights is definitely not that way, is it?
No. I would say, like I said, the opposite from it. And the first couple of tests, I did not enjoy it at all because it was so different. You know, like you said, in all of the single seater system, like in Europe and everything that I've driven up until the Indy Lights point, was that kind of slow is fast. Take good care of your tire. Don't slide around too much and hit your marks, hit your apex, and you'll be good. And I was usually that's usually my normal driving style as well. But then jumping into the Indy Lights, I drove with the same that I've always driven. And I found myself half a second off the pace. And I couldn't for the life of me understand where that time was. And then I remember like a couple of the tests last year, comparing to my teammate then, David Malukas, looked back and looked at his data and video, and he was all over the place, you know, steering more right in a left-hand corner than I've ever seen anybody do. And for some reason, it was just fast. And I was just like, is that how you're supposed to drive it? And that's it. That's how you're supposed to drive it, because it's something with this car, and I think more so with this tire. Like any other type of tire that I've had does not like surface temperature. But for some reason, the Cooper tire, the more you slide it, the faster you'll go. So, you know, it's when you think theoretically in your head what the fastest lap would be, that's not how you actually do it on track. You just hustle the car with whatever you have. You don't really need to hit every apex. As long as you carry enough speed and you're early on power, the lap time is going to come out of it. So it is very tricky to master, especially after like coming from Europe and trying to adapt to that driving style. But once you get the hang of it, like so much fun, and it's very rewarding. Like once you do hook up a lap together and you do like a really good, like say pole lap, you feel so rewarding after it. And that's what I've been enjoying to do this year as well, because I think we put some good laps together.
I guess it's like adding rally driving to your CV now after a year in Indy Lights.
Honestly, yeah, a little bit. I think on a mini scale, that's pretty much what it's like.
No Volvos yeah. In Indy Lights, though, unfortunately. As much as that would
not
be nice.
Not yet.
I guess you obviously got to test the Andretti IndyCar in the last off season. So I guess you have not a lot of experience, obviously, but some experience. So can you see why it's quite? I'm trying to word this in a way that isn't offensive to anyone who's gone into IndyCar, like to make it sound easy, but it seems like the Indy Lights car is a really good training ground for going into IndyCar. And we've seen a lot of the recent champions go from Indy Lights, or even people who finished in the top three in Indy Lights go into IndyCar and immediately be, you know, relatively competitive at least. So can you see that transition? Can you see why that's possible having driven both cars now?
Yeah, 100%. I think Indy Lights is the perfect training grounds to jump up to IndyCar. And we've seen it, like you mentioned in the past, you know, every driver that does well in Indy Lights seems to be able to do well in IndyCar as well, which is good when you look at it from my perspective. And like I said, I did a test with Andretti end of last year. And that was, until this weekend, the best day of my life. Now this one trumps it. But yeah, I could see why it's quite easy for Indy Lights drivers to adapt to the IndyCar, because honestly, in some ways, the IndyCar was a little bit easier to drive because it just did everything so much nicer. Had more grip, it was more sophisticated, you got more tools, and obviously a lot more people to help you with setup, and you got more data to look at. So it was cool. It was fun. Obviously, it was still tough. I think one of the toughest parts was the physical aspect. But in terms of just pure driving, it was, I would say, actually a little bit easier than the Lights car.
Yeah, I guess it's much better to have the difficult part first and the easier part second than the other way around.
yeah, I do think the competition is way higher in IndyCar, though. So it's not going to be, it's never going to be easy, is there?
No, definitely. I guess so. So talking about all of that, I guess speaking about how you've adapted to the Indy Lights car and I guess the similarities between the Indy car, I guess you must be feeling quite confident about next year in terms of you do get that chance to step up and kind of where's the mindset at the minute? I'm sure you're not going to give us an exclusive right now on the Race IndyCar podcast to tell us exactly what you're doing next year, because I'm sure that's not the case. But tell us, you know, how confident you are that you're going to get, you know, you're going to get to take up your scholarship next year and maybe expand on that a little bit with some more races. I'm sure that's what you're desperately trying to do at the moment.
Yeah, if I had an exclusive, I'd tell you. but sadly, I don't know what I'm doing yet. Obviously, the target is to be in IndyCar full-time next year. We'll see what happens. Obviously, the news that came out today with Pelot and Rosenqvist will have a bit of a domino effect. So I think a lot of my future will be determined within the next couple of days or within the week. So we'll see what happens. But I do believe that, like you said, if I do get the chance, I feel confident that we can do a good job. And it's things like you look at both Kirkwood and David, and maybe especially David this year. You know, he's performed very well, been on the podium and been able to challenge at the front. And it will be interesting to see what Cal can do in the Andretti next year, when we know he's a super talented driver. And you know, things like that, because on my day I was able to challenge and even beat those guys. So I know that, you know, if I perform at my top, I'm at least as good as they are. So yeah, it makes me feel confident for next year.
For sure. I guess just bringing it back to your Indy Lights season, obviously 5 wins, a really you know, nice number of podiums as well, and everything on paper looks really good. Is there a key moment, do you think, looking back on the year that was really important for you, or is there any of the wins that kind of stand out as meaning a little bit more than any of the others to you?
I'd say the two wins at Detroit are the one that pops into my head first. Mm. Because Detroit was my favorite track out of all the places last year. But I didn't manage to win a race. I managed to get a pole and then 2 second places in the race. So it was one of those places where when I knew that I was coming back, I was just like, yeah, Detroit is the one. I just want to win. Which we did. We won both of the races and 2 pole positions. And the way that we did it as well, I think we were like 0.5 to 0.6 clear in quali. So it was just like one of those perfect weekends for me. So that one will always be nice. The second one I will say is the pole that we had at Gateway, because that was my first ever pole on an oval. And it was nice to sort of prove to myself that I was able to do it.
Yeah. I guess Detroit, you had the pole, the fastest lap and the win as well. So you had like the hat trick for both races. That's always nice as a driver when you've got that. When you notch that hat trick, it's always nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking, I guess, in terms of the opposite of that, it feels like, you know, this second season that you've had in Indy Lights, you've kind of been able to be more consistent, and I guess not even more consistent, but just consistently, you know, higher up in terms of what you've been able to achieve, less kind of difficult moments, I guess. And some of those last year were out of your control, I know, but it definitely feels like you've kind of taken a step up in terms of the consistency that you've been able to bring this year. And, you know, would you say that is the case, and you feel like maybe that's something you worked on in the off season to try and be a little bit more consistent and try and take some of those results, rather than trying to force too much? I guess that's always the big thing when you're in a championship battle.
Yes, 100%. And that was one of the key things that we try to focus on during the off season and preparing for this year. You know, we try to identify what we did good last year, but also what we didn't do too good. And I think one of those things were that, you know, on our day, we were as fast as anybody. But when we had our bad days, that wasn't a P3, P4. That was a P8, P9. And we wanted to minimize that and sort of raise our lowest level. And I think we've done a really good job of that. And saying to us ourselves as well that we're not going to win every race. But when we have a bad day, let's try to at least be on the podium or be in the top 5. And I think that's ultimately how you win a championship. I mean, you look at someone like Will Power this year. You know, it's the consistency that at the end of the line, end of the day, is going to get you over the line.
Mm. And you saved the worst result of the season for the championship winning race, I guess. So that's that's just weird as well that he saved that for that race.
Yeah, kind of ironic, isn't it?
yeah, for sure. Well, Linus, thanks so much for spending some time with the Race IndyCar Podcast. We really appreciate it, and we'll definitely be keeping a close eye in the coming weeks and months in the silly season to see where you end up. But best of luck with everything.
Yeah, cheers. I hope you will be, and I'll chat to you soon, Jack. Thanks, man.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, everyone. That was Linus Lundqvist. Hope you enjoyed that interview. It's nice to kind of get a nice recorded interview with him, to be honest, because we've written a few features on Linus through the year on the race, and he's just such a bubbly personality and someone who you can just imagine is absolutely banging the door down of every single team boss in the IndyCar series paddock at the moment. So, he's a brilliant character, someone who's, you know, really genuine and lovely guy. So it's nice to see him achieve the success that he's looking for. And we'll definitely keep an eye on the next few weeks regarding where he ends up next year and what he ends up doing. So, Tony, we're going to move on to Indy Pro 2000 now with a fellow Brit, Louis Foster. So, it was nice to have two Brits at the same time. I thought the podcast might explode, but everything seemed to be still working afterwards. So that was good. A 7-win season, having come over from racing in Europe and around. It's his sixth year of car racing this year. He's finished second and third a lot in the championships that he's done, to be honest. He's done British F4, British F3, finished second in Euro Formula Open last year, which is a championship that does a lot of the European tracks and even supports F1 in some cases. I feel like he's a driver who's he has bounced around a lot, and it felt like maybe we were just getting to the point where he's done so many years of car racing now that he needed to come in and win this championship, and he'll definitely address that in our interview coming up. Tony, I guess maybe the most impressive thing in Louis' case was his kind of how quickly he adapted to some of the things that were new to him, like the ovals especially, and street courses he hadn't raced on before as well. And, you know, St. Pete wasn't exactly ideal for him. He still feels like there was a bit left on the table there. That was his first, obviously, race in Indy Pro 2000. He's still trying to learn the Cooper tyres at that point and sort of bed into the team and stuff like that. But by the time we got to the second street course, you know, towards the end of the season at Toronto, he was able to do the hat trick there with Paul's fastest laps and wins, and kind of similar to Linus Lundqvist at Detroit situation where he totally dominated. And then the oval win seemed like more of a veteran performance. You know, he let some of the other guys run out in the lead at the start and just looked after his tyres, looked after his equipment, and then picked them off as they started to fall back. And I don't know, from inside the paddock, Tony, was the oval win maybe the point of the season where, you know, people really start to take notice of Louis Foster, do you think, and sort of sit up and take notice?
Yeah, I think that was a standout point. You know, we talked how Indy Lights kind of had a similar 6-7 guys that were close-ish. Well, Indy Pro started where it was 6 or 7 guys close-ish, where it was like between Reese Gold, Nolan Siegel, a few others, and I'm on that at Hinkos Hollinger as well, the Jay Howard group. And Louis was just running this gamut of bad luck where it seemed like whenever he had an opportunity to win, he got taken out by his teammate, or he just fell off the road, or something went wrong. I just had the feeling, you know, and kind of watching the Indy Road Course weekend, really with the pace of the exclusive autosport team that Michael Duncast group has put together. Once he got that first win, you just had the sense that kind of the dam would break open, and getting a road course win again was not a shock. It was very much anticipated. But yeah, once he got to IRP, once he got to, you know, for those that don't know, the Lucas Oil Indianapolis Raceway Park, it's a very flat oval. It's a little under 0.7 miles, and you kind of have to run the high line. And as Jack mentioned, you do try to save your tires early on. So you're going up against guys, this is his first ever oval race, right? And guys that should know better, frankly, given their level of guys that should know better given their level of experience. In fact, the guy who he passed, you know, Reese Gold, he was a guy that was in a similar position last year and also didn't manage his tires again. So I'm like, dude, you're a sophomore. You should have learned that by now. And the fact that Louis got him, ran away with it, and then maintained the pace later on, I was like, okay, you've done it now 2 events in a row. It's kind of a nice symmetry. It was a Freedom 90. He's driving car number 90. It was a 90 lap race. It was a very, very impressive performance that again kind of set him on the right path for the rest of the season.
Absolutely. So we'll hear from Louis Foster in just a minute. He's won the scholarship to compete in Indy Lights next year, and we already know what he's doing. Luckily enough, he's announced that he's racing for Andretti Autosport, so he'll be teammates with Hunter McElroy, we talked about earlier, who's likely to be, I think, a front runner in that championship. And yeah, it looks like with a couple of teams coming into Indy Lights, looks like the grid's going to be even bigger, you know, next season. So we'll be looking forward to that. But back on topic with Indy Pro 2000, and we'll go and speak to Louis Foster.
So Louis Foster, thanks so much for joining us on the Race IndyCar podcast. I guess you had a fun weekend because you were with Andretti, your new team in IndyCar at Laguna Seca. Tell us how that was.
Yeah, so obviously did the deal with them and announced our signing on Thursday, and then traveled up to Monterey, Laguna Seca. I live in LA, so it wasn't too bad of a drive going up there. And yeah, spent the weekend with the team, you know, basically just learning as much as I can about, you know, how they do things and what they're about and this, that, and the other. You know, again, it's a new team for me that, you know, I wanted to kind of get used to. So when we go into testing, you know, it's not first hellos. It's nice to see you again kind of thing, you know? So yeah, it was nice to be with them and feel a part of that team.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I guess I wanted to pick up and start with, I know you've said a few times this year that you felt like 2022 was kind of like a must-win championship year for you, which I think is really interesting because obviously you made a huge step. I know you've been planning to kind of move to America for a little while now, but it was still in racing terms a big step to come over and try street courses and ovals and things like that for the first time with a new team against a load of drivers that you'd never raced against before. But you still kind of felt like that was a must win kind of year for you. So tell us a little bit about what your kind of mindset was going into the season and why you felt that way.
You know, for me, obviously, yes, it was difficult to, you know, adapt to everything and new team and new environment, living in a new place, being away from family and friends, was tricky at first, but, you know, I settled in well and got used to it. Yeah, I mean, the main reason why I would say it was a crunch year for me or a bit of a must win year is, you know, the scholarship money at the end of it was needed for me to progress up to Indy Lights. We needed to win it and claim the Road to Indy sponsor scholarship money in order to progress further. So for me, it was very much, you know, if I wanted to continue racing and if I wanted to continue doing single seaters, especially that I needed to win. Of course, yes, if I came second or third or didn't do as well, we probably would have taken a second year. But you know, for me, I wanted to, you know, get it done and get onto Indy Lights as soon as possible, really.
Yeah, I guess it's just been a bit of a roller coaster in terms of the way you've gone about it, but obviously it's worked out extremely well in the end and you got the championship that you were looking for. And I guess a key part of that and a key part of, I guess, I don't want to say like the American paddock and the American media, I don't think it's as far as saying like taking you seriously, but I think a big moment in the season where you really kind of announced yourself to a lot of people was the oval win and how you went about that. Talk us through, you know, kind of how you felt in the lead up to that and whether you thought that was possible, because I think we've seen this quite a lot in recent years, especially in IndyCar with some of the, you know, the Formula One guys like Romain Grosjean and Marcus Ericsson coming over and maybe taking a little bit of time to adapt to the ovals and learning how they work. But your race win, you know, you looked like an oval veteran. You let the guys kind of, you know, run out fast at the start of the race. You kept your own pace and, you know, you kind of eased into it and were very sensible about how you approached it. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, obviously, first time at an oval was the race at IRP, Lucas Oil Oval. It's quite a small, strange oval. From what I was told before going there, you know, you run the high line the entire way around the track because it's progressively banked. So, you know, you don't dip down towards the apron like, you know, you would assume you would do. Looking outside in, you hold the high line. You're on the wall the entire lap because that's the fastest way around the track. So yeah, it was definitely difficult to get used to it. We had a test day or two before the race weekend, like most teams, to get used to it. So yeah, and then to be honest with you, I narrowed it down really a little bit. You know, looking at ovals outside in seem, from a far perspective, they seem easy because you just go around in circles. Once you kind of talk to people and get into a bit more, it gets a bit more tricky because you kind of understand there's a lot of things that go on during an oval. It is very precise and it is very tricky. But yeah, I just kind of narrowed it down to just two fast left-handers, really. I was like, I'm not going to overcomplicate it. It just is what it is. They're just banged left-handers. But yeah, obviously I worked quite hard for the team on the test days to make sure that we were up to pace for the race. And yeah, honestly, during the race, I wasn't expecting a win. you know, after starting third and kind of being third for the half of the race, I was, you know, pretty content finishing third, really. In my first ever race, I was happy to take a podium. And then, yeah, the two guys in front of me, their tires just started to fall off, and I think they were pushing too hard. And yeah, they just kind of came back to me, and I managed to get the overtakes done and then pull a gap. So yeah, it was quite a surreal experience, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And I guess street circuits have been new to you this season as well. And I know, you know, St. Pete probably didn't work out exactly how you wanted. It was obviously your first race in the championship. And I know how difficult it can be to adapt from, you know, tyres that are typically used in Europe to the Cooper tyres, are obviously very different in the road to Indy. But by the time we had reached Toronto later in the season, you're able to take pole, fastest lap in both races and win both the races. So I guess we can say that street courses, let's not say you've mastered them, but you definitely were a lot more comfortable by the time we got to Toronto, let's say.
Yeah, definitely. I think I do think that St. Pete, I'd still do decently well in. I mean, got double podium. Left it P2 in the standings. Just had an unfortunate qualifying, got out by a red flag, which means I qualified a bit lower down than I would have hoped to. But I enjoy street courses again. Like, even since turning up at St. Pete, you know, I really enjoy it because it there's no room for error, which I like. I like that, you know, I can't lock up and go off and be like, oh well, whatever, you know, I ruined my lap, but we'll carry on. I like that it's you know, you can't make mistakes, and it tends to mean that drivers underdrive a little bit, whereas I like that. And you know, I've enjoyed them. I'm looking forward to the ones that I'll do next year in Indy Lights. You know, new street courses I'm really looking forward to. So yeah, no, 100%. I think throughout the year we definitely adapted a lot to the car and the tires and fully figured it out.
And all of that led to the championship, and now you're heading to Andretti in Indy Lights, which is always a seat that lots of different drivers are trying to get, and it's not always one that's easy to get into. It's always a bit of an honour when Andretti sort of allows you to take up a seat there in Indy Lights because of how competitive they've been in the championship over the past few years. So I guess give us an idea of your expectations and your goals for next season. Now you're, you know, in one of the best teams in Indy Lights and one of the biggest names in American motorsport as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, like I said, it's been kind of a bit of a surreal last few months with all the signing and the deals and talking to these teams. You know, to me, it means a lot that they appreciate and value my efforts, and they acknowledge my achievements. So yeah, I mean, we're gonna go into preseason testing. I think our first test is Chris Griffiths' first time I'll hop in the Indy Lights car, which is, I believe, end of October. So I've got a while now. We'll try our hardest as always. You know, 100% effort, 110% effort. The approach stays the same from last year. I don't need to change my approach because, you know, clearly it works. So, I think the goal, as always, is to win. You know, it'll be definitely a lot more difficult this year, as it always will be. Every year you go up, it's going to get harder and harder. So, yeah, I'll be trying my hardest to make sure that we can have podiums, wins, and hopefully have a good hold on the championship battle towards the end of the season.
Yeah, for sure. And now you've got a bit of time in this off season. Is there anything you want to do either, I guess, with Andretti or from a general life enjoyment kind of point of view? You're obviously out in LA and there's plenty of fun stuff to do out there. So what's the plans for the off season and how are you going to prepare for next year?
Preparation wise for next year, obviously staying fit, healthy and training and all that malarkey. So obviously we're doing that as always. And then obviously with Andretti, you know, preparing for every test, making sure that I turn up to each test ready to go and maximizing the amount of seat time that I get. It's quite limited seat time this year because obviously the Indy Lights car has gone from Cooper tires to Firestones. There's a bit of a tire shortage at the moment. So it's making it quite difficult to do test days because, you know, there's just no tires. You can't really run a race car without any tires. So yeah, so it will be a bit tricky. So definitely need to make the most of the limited days we will be getting to adapt to the new car and, you know, get to know my engineer and work with him and et cetera. So 100% need to make the absolute most of that. as for general life stuff, really, I mean, I'm pretty content, you know, as long as I'm just, you know, making sure that I'm being active on a day-to-day basis. And yeah, I'm pretty chilled. I've been in LA for about a year now, so it's kind of getting to the stage where most things touristy are a little bit boring, if you know what I mean. I'm not going to go to the Santa Monica and ride on the roller coaster anytime soon, so.
Awesome. Well, it's always good fun to talk to another Brit, even though I'll probably get accused of bias for having you on the podcast. But it's been great to speak to you, and we'll definitely be keeping a close eye on how you get on in Indy Lights next year.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it, Jack.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
All right, it was a lot of fun speaking to another Brit, as I said. It's nice to share that on the podcast. So, yeah, don't worry. We're not giving any unfair bias to Louis, and he's not going to appear on every single episode of the Race IndyCar podcast next year. So we'll keep that to a minimum. But it's good to see him there, and a very talented young driver who's definitely going to work hard in Indy Lights. And I think he'll surprise a few people next year with what he's able to achieve. I'd like to move on to SF 2000 now, Tony, because for me, this was kind of the most interesting one, really. And it's quite often works that way, I think, for people who maybe are not quite as on the beat as you are and don't necessarily know all of the drivers coming into SF 2000. Because sometimes you get a few surprises, or, you know, people who you're not really expecting to be front runners kind of pop up out of nowhere. Or just generally, it's a stacked championship with a lot of cars and you can have some really good battles. So Michael D'Orlando was the champion this season, but he came into the last round 23 points behind entering the title finale, and his title rivals all hit trouble in that Portland finale. So yeah, an absolutely balmy season, really, from every aspect. What was your kind of standout moment in this season, Tony?
I think it's interesting with Michael. He's a very down-to-earth, you know, kid. He's from New York, but he's a third-year driver in USF 2000 compared to Miles Rowe, who's in his second season, Jace Denmark, who's in his second season at Pabst Racing. The three of them were the primary championship contenders. And he never really had that big of a standout moment. I mean, he had a couple wins early in the season. Again, he had another win on the Indianapolis Raceway Park Oval, which he did last year as well. I won at Road America, but he had kind of a toughish midseason, and he wasn't really quite in contention. And after, you know, coming in so far down, quite how resilient he was. And I think using that experience to his advantage in Portland, I think, is what kind of did it. Because the moment that I think the championship wasn't necessarily won for D'Orlando, but was lost for Miles Rowe, was in the first race on the Friday, I believe. Rowe was battling another car for a podium position. He fought it probably a little harder than he needed to, and that dropped him from third to 10th. And so in that one moment, you took a guaranteed podium and further points situation, and it just kind of went out the window, and it made more of a pressure for races 2 and 3. So when D'Orlando was in the position to win in the final race of the year, again, after more of just utter pain and you know, agony for Pabst with both their drivers, I think it was that experience that kind of shone through. And you could see his emotion just as he got up on the winner's step on Saturday in the final race and just realized what he'd accomplished. I think the other thing that's cool for Michael is this is Cape Motorsports' last season in the championship, and they have been call it your team Penske or Chip Ganassi Racing of USF 2000. This is a team that is very, very strong. I think JR may have even had his championship for them back in the day. So yes, I'm old. They have been just, you know, the benchmark that every team has been shooting for, and they've had a lot of champions. And I think there was a sense, I think Pabst probably wanted to beat them while they still could. And for it to kind of go away and for Michael to rally the way he did in what was a very pivotal season. You know, it's rare that you do 3 years in USF. You usually try to advance after two, but I think he had some good wisdom and advice to stay for a third year, and he maximized that.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because I think definitely in something like F2 or F3 and in some of the European series, even if a driver does two or three seasons in a junior single seater category, it usually works quite considerably against them when it comes to, you know, how they're rated as drivers. And sometimes it's difficult for them to step up to other championships because they have a hard time convincing teams that they should get the chance because they've taken, you know, a little bit longer in some of these championships. But I think there's also to temper that point, I think it's also, you know, important to point out that in the likes of IndyCar, you know, I've spent a lot of time praising, you know, how consistent Will Power has been this season. And, you know, just because Michael has been racing in this series for a long time, he's shown improvement in each season. And if we praise consistency in other championships, we probably should do it in this one as well. And Michael was, you know, there to pick up the pieces. And I think it was really, really cool that you pointed out the kind of Miles Rowe. I don't know if you call it an error or a mistake, because I guess, you know, he's fighting for position at the end of the day. And these things are, you know, in the moment, it's a split second decision to make for Miles there. But like you said, that's the kind of decision that wins you a championship or loses you one, unfortunately. And very, very sad not to see Miles, you know, with everything he's been through over the past 2 years to not win the championship, but also, you know, Michael's worked hard and shown a lot of consistency. So without further ado, we'll jump over and we'll speak to Michael D'Orlando right now. So welcome back, and I'm joined by Michael D'Orlando. How are you doing, Michael? Thanks for joining us on the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you doing?
Yeah, all good. But yeah, I guess we should start with the championship finale. I guess going into Portland, you were 23 points behind in the championship, and you were obviously able to overturn that over the weekend. So give us an idea of the kind of emotional roller coaster and kind of what it took to actually win the championship in the end, and obviously congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. What a crazy weekend, honestly, being 23 points back, and especially, like, you always had the attitude that it's not over till it's over, and so we knew that we were in, we had a fighting shot, and we definitely knew that if we just kept pushing that we'd our luck would pay off at some point. And the funny part is, in test session two, I actually put it in the wall. I lost the rear end in turn four, and then spun around, put the car on the wall, and missed my practice session that day. So I missed the session, went straight to qualifying, and I was like, all right, just going to go drive and do the best that I can. Pulled off ninth place qualifying. Not the greatest, to be completely honest. So in race one, I ended up finishing seventh, and then race two, fourth. And I guess it was kind of exactly what I needed to do, was keep my head down a bit, just focus on my own race, let everything else play out. Because while Chase was up front, that made both of them kind of, like, I guess, need to go out and just absolutely win. Because if they let the other one win, then they end up taking a lead, and they're thinking about the championship the whole time. And I'm just sitting here like, I'm just going to let you guys play this out, and I'm going to come through, which is exactly what happened. And I don't know how that happened, but like, I guess it's, I don't know, I guess it's the experience of maturity. I don't really understand why it worked out so well for me this weekend. But I'd like to think that it's a payoff for the past 2 years, because last year was a little tough, and then the year before it was like my first year in USF 2000. So I'd like to think it's kind of like a payoff that, yeah, definitely a little bit of luck happened. But if it wasn't for the fact that I kept my head down and I kept my swallowing my emotions to get through the weekend, that it would pay off, and it ended up doing it. So in the last race, I ended up making it all the way up front from sixth place, and just led the entire race from there. And God, like, when I crossed that finish line, I did not believe it. Like, I kept asking, did I do it? And they're like, yeah, you did. And I didn't believe it until I got to turn six and I started tearing up. Like, damn, this is like 15 years in the making of like winning a championship in power racing. So it's been a fantastic, like, it was a really, really emotional weekend.
What have you done to celebrate since? How did you cap it all off?
I think, the boat days today is going to be nice. Since then, it's just, you know, been going out to dinners with the family and obviously the celebration that we have on Sunday night where you get your awards and everything. That's always pretty fun. That's always really fun. But nothing too crazy. I mean, I'm a college student, so I've, you know, been going out with some friends recently. And I think we're doing something this weekend in Northern North Carolina. That's where I go to school. It's UNC Charlotte. Might be going to Greensboro. But other than that, it's nothing crazy. Just typical school stuff, do some work, and then chill out with friends. But nothing super special for celebration. Not really. Just been excited, very excited all week.
I can tell it's contagious. I guess, yeah. You kind of touched on last year a little bit, and kind of wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because I guess if you look at your stats from this season, they're actually really, really similar to last year in terms of how many races you've won and how many podiums you've had and stuff like that. There's not a lot of difference there. So how do you feel like you've developed as a driver this season? And I guess, did missing out on the championship last year really kind of give you extra motivation to push on this year and achieve what you have?
Oh, obviously missing out on the championship last year did give me the extra motivation. And after last year, we actually weren't sure what I was going to do. Obviously, with budget constraints and having a brother in motorsports, it was a quite difficult choice. And the Capes and I and our sponsors, like Rising Star Racing, definitely came together and said that it's probably the best option to go and stay in USF 2000 and get the championship, because that'll be an extra thing that you can learn. And I think from the biggest thing that I learned from this year to last year is I normally see myself as an attacker and a driver that like will always go for the move. I'm an attacker. I can move up from any position. But the problem with that is that I'm not patient. So there was a couple of times this year and a lot of times last year that I ended up putting myself in a bad situation because of just trying too fast.
You mentioned Cape Motorsports there, obviously a really significant team in junior motorsports in America. I guess kind of coincidentally, considering I'm the one talking, set up by some Brits. But I guess what's it like to drive for them? And I know they're two, you know, really fun guys to be around. But in terms of, you know, what they've been able to achieve in motorsport, they must be one of the best teams to give you a platform to be able to compete for the success that you've had this year.
Definitely. They haven't won 14 championships in 2-liter cars for no reason. So obviously, me being the 14th, they've been very, very good to me the past 2 years, and especially every other driver they've worked with. But I'll be the last USF 2000 winner for them, which is honestly quite an honor. It feels like an honor. But they've done everything. They're super serious about the sport, and they're super. They have a lot of perseverance. They're super dedicated to it. So they put every ounce of soul of what they have into motorsports, and I absolutely adore it. So working with them for the past 3 years has been amazing, and just honestly felt like at home. And it's the case too. They've been around a while, so it's not even all like work. They're really great guys. They can put together a good race team. But even going out to dinner with them every night is always a good experience. So working with them has been a huge blessing.
Yeah, I'm sure it has. I guess that kind of moves us on to the next question. And obviously, the great thing about the Road to Indy is the scholarships that it offers for its champions. So where are you at with your, you know, planning for next year and how everything's going? What do you know, and what I guess is yet to be sorted for you for next season?
Well, we have yet to do any testing with any teams for Indy Pro 2000 yet. I know my brother has been racing for EA. So if Nick does end up racing for EA next year, there might have a little bit of a deal, or like, you know, two kids, maybe lower the cost down a bit. We haven't really done any testing. We've just been looking into them and talking. I've been talking to a couple of team owners, like Oni Pabs, like Yonkos, EA, Michael Donkef at EA. So I haven't really done anything super, super in-depth yet. I know some drivers, you know, did a a couple of tests before the season ends. And, you know, maybe that's why they, you know, failed in this last race weekend. But Jason Miles, maybe they were focusing on Indy Pro and they're like, oh, yeah, we got this in, we got this race weekend in the bag. And next thing you know, I come out and be like, yeah, no, you don't. But, but anyways, maybe they moved shifted the focus too quick. I don't know. But yeah, I haven't focused on Indy Pro yet. So that's going to be something that happens in the near future for sure.
I guess just to kind of finish off here, give us maybe one fact that the listeners might not know about you, kind of introducing some of the Road to Indy guys to an IndyCar podcast. What might be something that IndyCar fans might not know about you as a driver?
So I don't know if it's an unusual thing, but I'm not just a driver. I actually focus myself a lot more in the car realm anyways. Like, I'm a huge car guy. I have a 2013 Subaru WRX that I work on. So I don't know a lot of drivers that, you know, are also car guys as well. I know Graham Rahal is, he's got his whole program thing going on with that too. But that's pretty much what I do. I've made a whole group of friends, and I'm actually starting up or having a whole bunch of us start up like a car meet group in Charlotte. So we can get that, the community up and going with that too. That'd be super fun. But that's pretty much me on the side of it. I'm just, you know, it's all happy-go-lucky guy that likes driving and working on race cars. So that's pretty much me.
Has that given you, do you feel like it's given you a better understanding of, you know, what you're able to kind of feed back in terms of, you know, what you're telling the team and stuff like that? Is it giving you a bit more of a kind of global perspective of I guess, how a race team works and how you can obviously improve the feedback and the level of engineer on the car as well?
Yeah, it definitely has. I think understanding cars, especially like the ones that I work on, I can kind of go from car to car and understand the terminology and kind of how it works. I'm not super in depth. I'm not like a, you know, certified AAA mechanic, but like, you know, it's not like, but I have a pretty good understanding of what does what. And I think I can, on any given day, if I wanted to, you know, go out and test a car, that 90% of the time I will, or maybe 95% of the time, I'm going to be correct. I feel like I would be correct in what I would need to change, to get a certain thing out of the car. So if I like oversteer, then I, like, depending on where it is, you change this or that, but maybe a little bit of rest of the thing. I think in terms of understanding cars, it definitely helps me a little bit more and gives me an advantage in that, because I can talk a little bit more technical to the engineer and we can kind of bounce things off each other. Like, me and Dominic bounce things off each other, like, yeah, what if we did this? And it's like, okay, well, maybe instead of doing that, we can do this thing. And I would completely understand where he's coming from that. So it definitely helps in the race car from understanding how to set up the car and get the most out of it. But, and the reason why I do it is purely because I love it. That's really why.
Awesome. Well, Michael, thanks so much for joining us. You came from 23 points back at the start of the weekend to win the USF 2000 Championship at Portland. So a big congratulations on that. Thanks for joining us. And thanks for delaying your trip out onto the lake to speak to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
He's definitely very, I think, did you use the word humble earlier, Tony? I think I think that's definitely a good word to describe him. And he definitely knows, you know, things worked out well for him this season. And he did get a little bit of that fortune, especially in the last round. But, you know, he still worked hard to achieve what he has this year. So what do you expect to see from him next season in terms of, he's obviously not sure what he's going to do just yet, but we're obviously expecting him to take the scholarship and jump up to Indy Pro. Are you expecting him to fight for the championship kind of immediately in Indy Pro? Or do you think we're going to see, you know, something similar along the lines of what we've seen from him in USF 2000? Maybe he's going to take a little bit of time to bed in.
I would say it's very team dependent in Indy Pro 2000. I mean, there's a lot of good teams. There's probably four or five that have championship and or race winning potential depending on the weekend. I mean, whether it's an exclusive, whether it's a Hinkos Hollinger. I mean, Cape, his team that he's been with, is stepping to Indy Lights. So he'll be learning a new group of people wherever it is. And I think just by nature, depending on either the testing or the preseason program he has, if he starts strong, that'd be great, but I don't anticipate it right out of the gate. So we'll see what he does though. I think he's, you know, I think that the thing that's cool about really Road to Indy in general is that you never know what moments in your career are going to be those pivotal ones that either keep it going or don't. So if he's able to progress further as a result of this championship win, and for Miles' sake, I hope he does too. I mean, you know, he was an excellent title rival combatant, and clearly he's shown what he's capable of. I think they just need a little bit more consistency and a little bit racecraft enhancements at times. So hopefully the two of them are able to continue their battle, similar to how Kirkwood and Malukas did, or Lundqvist might be able to do versus Malukas, or however. That's one of the coolest things about it, is seeing these kind of sort of rivalries or battles continue and progress up the ladder.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess with Miles, you know, it's he obviously had a few years out and came back last year and got the full season in, and then, you know, faced a load of uncertainty in the off season, and I guess didn't know whether he was going to be racing again this season. So I guess the fundamental thing for him to kind of unlock his top level is to actually get a good run at, you know, consistently competing in a championship and knowing that he's going to have that chance. But also, we all know that's part of junior open wheel racing, that sometimes there's not that certainty there if you're not someone who's well funded. So it's part of what you've got to race with, and part of, you know, you have to compete with that pressure on you, which is I guess part of this journey. So Tony, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. I know you do a lot of great work with Steve Wittick on Trackside Online, and I know you're very active on Twitter, as we mentioned earlier as well. So give us a little bit of a flavor of where people can read more of your work, and also, you know, where they can find you on your social media channels as well.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. And, you know, like you said, my colleague and friend Steve Wittick's been really good with the Road to Indy stuff on Trackside Online and TSO Ladder. So those are the primary places. I tend to do a handful of events on site per year. It's usually month of May into Road America timeframe, which is usually my favorites. But there also are a couple more that come online toward the end of the year. And then at Tony DiZino on Twitter for my random thoughts, musings, insights, deep dives, statistical nerddom, and whatever else banter you want to call out.
Well, thank you very much. And we're definitely looking forward to keeping up with what you've got to write about next season. So that's all for this episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. Make sure you're checking out www.the-race.com for all your news and features that I have to advertise to you every single episode. And also make sure that you go and check out our new app, which is very easy to use on your phone. And yeah, it's definitely an upgrade when you're using your mobile and stuff like that. So definitely give that a go. We'll say another big thank you to Tony DiZino for joining us on this episode. We'll hope to have him back at some point next season to talk about this kind of stuff again. If you did enjoy a bit more of an episode based on the junior series, then let us know. Send us a tweet, or you can email us podcasts@the-race.com. Yeah, let us know. If you want us to do more stuff like this, then we need you to step up and let us know, and then we can do it. So just give us a shout. So that's all for this week's episode, and we'll speak to you soon.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.